I'm at Genesis chapter 49 right now. Genesis chapter 49. I'm going to read in Genesis 49, verses 1 to 28. It's not the entirety of the chapter, but it's a large portion of it. Just to context again, Jacob is reaching the end of his life. Even the last time 3 weeks ago that we looked in the book of Genesis, Jacob actually then was dying. So this really is falling very closely on the heels of the meeting that Jacob had with Joseph, where Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh. So we are now here at Genesis chapter 49. Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency and dignity of and excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people, binding his donkey to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his brother shall adjoin Sidon. Issachar is a strong donkey, lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good, and the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden, and became a band of slaves. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Gad, a troop, shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil." All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. This passage before us is what some people have called the judgment seat of Jacob. And that is a memorable way of saying it, but it's not entirely all about the judgment of Jacob. It's important as we look at this passage to remember that these are not just the words of Jacob. These are actually words, an oracle that is given by inspiration of God. as we look at this passage, there are three very important themes that run through this passage. The first theme is personal responsibility and the consequences of our actions. We are responsible for what we do, and there are consequences for what we do. The second theme that runs through this is the sovereignty of God. This is God's plan and God's map for what is going to happen with the sons of Jacob. This is not just Jacob's idea, and this is not just something that the boys of Jacob are going to aspire to. This is God's own pronouncement about what will be. God is in control. God is in control at all times. God is in control when we have a number of people coming here, and God is in control when we got nobody coming here. God is in control when people who fear God are in power in our government, and God is in control when people who do not fear God are in our government. God is in control when the righteous flourish, and God is in control when the righteous are cast down. God is in control when the wicked flourish, and God is in control when the wicked are cast down. God is in control. There is never a point in history where God is not in control. He rules over all. So that is the second very important theme that runs through this passage. The third theme that runs through this passage is also vital, and we cannot miss it. And that theme is the glory of Christ and the greatness of his kingdom. In the midst of the oracle about the sons of Jacob, God, in his plan for human history, speaks of the coming of Christ and speaks of the greatness of the kingdom that is Christ. The kingdom over which Christ will reign on this earth. And we will see all of these three themes as we look at this passage. But let's go person by person through this. I'll not linger. We don't have a lot of time, but let's go through this and see how these themes, personal responsibility and the consequences of our actions, the sovereignty of God, and the glory of Christ and his kingdom are revealed in this passage. First, we find Reuben. Reuben is spoken of in verses 3 and 4. Reuben is the firstborn. Reuben is the one that should have been the one that was the leader of the family. He's the one that should have had the birthright. But as our passage says, Reuben lost it due to his attempt to usurp the position of his father. We read about this back in chapter 35, verse 22, where Reuben went into one of Jacob's concubines and slept with her. Not only was it vile and incestuous, it was actually a power play. As the passage unfolds before us, there is a praise that transitions very sharply into a curse. We read it here in verse 3. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. All of that sounds really good. But then there's a sharp transition. He goes from the height of honor to the depth of shame. Chapter 49, verse 3. Verse 4, unstable as water, you shall not excel. Why? Because you went up to your father's bed, you defiled it, he went up to my couch. This is not the only place that we learn this truth, but Reuben's oracle, or the oracle concerning Reuben, reminds us very, very pointedly that our actions have repercussions. Reuben had in his mind what the consequences of the actions would be. And we went into it more in more detail when I went and preached through chapter 35. But Reuben here is making, he is usurping authority within the family. He is also trying to do what he can to elevate the position, no doubt, of his own mother. He did not expect what would come as a result of this. What kind of results come from Reuben's actions? Well, as we look forward in history, the oracle here of Jacob is very, very accurate. You shall not excel. How did that work itself out? Well, from this point on, Reuben as a tribe is mentioned very little. There will be no judge that comes from the tribe of Reuben. There will be no prophet that comes from the tribe of Reuben. There will be no military leader. There will be no other important individual that will rise up from the tribe of Reuben. Now, Reuben could never have guessed the full extent of the consequences of his actions, and neither can we. That thing that you are thinking of, that thing that you are dabbling in, that thing that you are hiding can cause harm and sorrow that will impact not only your life, but the lives of those that come after you. And we, I think, are seeing that in the verdict that was handed down this week with the former pastor of this church. He would never have guessed the full extent of the consequences of his actions, and yet his sin has found him out. May we, by God's grace, seek to always be faithful. We are responsible for what we do, and there are consequences for our actions. The oracle of Israel continues as Jacob speaks of Simeon and Levi. We find the oracle concerning Simeon and Levi in verses 5 to 7. And really, we see them described as violent and cruel and angry. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling places. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man. Then we see in verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. These expressions of violence and cruelty and anger reference back to the Dinah incident. When Dinah was defiled by Shechem, Simeon and Levi conspired and schemed in such a way that they told the men of Shechem, we will consent to have Dinah be married to the prince of Shechem if you will all be circumcised. Of course, they had no intention whatsoever of having Dinah be married to the prince of Shechem, nor should they have. He was a horrible and wicked individual who had taken advantage of a young woman. But what they did in response to that, this was all part of their scheme. When the men were incapacitated by the circumcision, they came and murdered all of the men and then took the women and children as captives. This very clearly references that Dinah incident. Neither Jacob nor, and more importantly, God was impressed with their vengeance. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. This reference to their council and assembly indicates their planning and scheming. This was not just a heat of the moment thing. This was planning and scheming. We would today call this mass first-degree murder and mass kidnapping. But they had this counsel. And Jacob here says, let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. There is a lesson here for us, a wise resolution for all of us. May we not enter into the council of the cruel. May we not find ourselves going along with them, planning together with the cruel. They are murderous. They kill in anger. They are cruel. This reference here in verse 6 to, in their self-will, they hamstrung an ox. Now, some translations say they tore down a wall or cast down a wall. I believe that hamstrung an ox is a better translation. It's one of those places where in the Hebrew language, it's not, you know, it's not a phonetic language. You have a language based on symbols, and just a small difference in a symbol can make a major difference in meaning. And that's why you have two very different things in different translations. Some translations then say that they destroyed a wall, but it seems more likely, given their own character, since over and over again, that since twice in this passage they're described as cruel, more than likely this is a needless animal abuse to hamstring an ox. As I read this, I was reminded of Proverbs 12 and verse 10. The righteous man regardeth the life of his beast, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. This is an example of extreme cruelty for no reason whatsoever. They hamstrung the ox, which essentially would mean that they cut the tendon on the back of the animal's leg. The result then of their actions is that they are divided in Jacob and scattered in Israel. Simeon will be given territory that is actually inside of Judah. If you look at a map later of the division of the tribes, you'll find that Judah entirely encircles Simeon. It's not a separate territory like the rest of the tribes. And in time, Simeon it really becomes just subsumed into the tribe of Judah. Now by the way, the reason I think why God divides Levi and Simeon is because the same reason that you divide two troublemakers when you have two kids messing up in kids' club. You put them in separate areas so they don't influence each other and cause more problems. This is the idea here. God is dividing up Simeon and Levi so that they don't come together in counsel in anger and cruelty and foolishness and sinfulness. And so this is the destiny of Simeon. They will be subsumed within the tribe of Judah. Levi, however, by God's grace, will become priests. Now this is tremendous grace. It is also, in a way, God's judgment. They will not receive any real land inheritance. They will, in time, have 48 cities that will be scattered throughout Israel, but they won't have any land inheritance. And even the priesthood that they will be given by God's grace will one day be no more. It's a temporary thing. Because Christ would fulfill the law, and Christ would become that perfect sacrifice, and Christ would be that great high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And it is notable that both of these two, so the leadership should have been Reuben's. It's taken because Reuben went up to his father's bed and defiled it. Who else would the leadership pass on to? Well, Simeon and Levi are the next oldest. You would think that the leadership of the family, the leadership of the nation, would pass on to Simeon and Levi. But because of their violent and angry actions, they do not get to be leadership in Israel. Again, we are reminded to consider the consequences of our actions. But we're also reminded about the greatness of God's grace. This is something that will be true of all of the sons of Jacob. The ones that are wise the ones that are foolish, the ones that are responsible and the ones that are irresponsible, the ones whose lives are dedicated to goodness and the ones whose lives are more dedicated to sinfulness. It'll be true of all of them. All of them receive God's grace because all of them end up in the promised land. God's grace is great. The next brother that was mentioned is in verses 8 to 12, and a larger portion is given. And there's a reason for that. This brother will be the most important son of Jacob in prophecy going forward. We'll see why in a moment. The passage begins by speaking of the ascendancy and the leadership of Judah. The leadership has passed from Reuben, it's passed from Simeon and Levi, and it rests now on Judah. The leadership of Judah is revealed in this passage when it speaks of, "You are he whom your brothers shall praise." It's revealed in the imagery of victory over enemies. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. It's revealed in further homage from his brothers, not just praise, but bowing down. Your father's children shall bow down before you. And it is also revealed in the image of a lion. This is all very positive, but as positive as this is relating to Judah and his descendants, it gets even better when we get to verse 10. Because in verse 10, a specific descendant of Judah is referred to. Jesus, the Messiah, is spoken of starting in verse 10. It says, "The power shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet." So Judah is going to be the one that has the authority. And that will be true. Judah will hold that authority until a specific descendant of Judah comes. And he is described as Shiloh. The scepter is, of course, a symbol of royal power. The lawgiver, a reference, of course, to the one who reigns and has the right to make the rules. Judah will have this power until it is handed over to a specific descendant of Judah, referred to here as Shiloh. Shiloh has the idea of peace, but it's not just referring to peaceful conditions. It's referring to a person. There's a sense in which this points to David, but even beyond David, to David's greater son. The power will rest upon Judah until it is given to the Messiah, Christ, because the power belongs to Christ. It says here that unto him shall be the obedience of the people. By the way, let me just pause for a minute and explain why I believe this speaks of a future earthly kingdom of Christ. The reason why I believe it refers to a future earthly kingdom of Christ is because that is the sense in which Judah will rule until it's given to Shiloh. It's not just here saying that Judah is going to be a good example, going to be wonderful at pointing people to spiritual realities. Judah would actually have the monarchy, they would actually have the right to reign and rule. So we see that Shiloh would come, and to Shiloh would be the obedience of the people. Those of the earth would bow down to Shiloh. The time of peace would come, and when the time of peace would come, embodied by the Prince of Peace, the people would bow to him. I think it's also telling here that it doesn't just say that his brothers would bow down or the descendants would bow down. It's wider than that. The future coming kingdom of Christ, I believe, is a kingdom worldwide in which Christ rules and reigns on earth. We see some of the conditions of this kingdom. The greatness of this kingdom is proclaimed. The ultimate fulfillment of this kingdom will be a time of wonder and plenty. And really, the end of verse 10 through verse 12 gives us a picture of what this will be like. It's a time of peace. It's a time of obedience to the properly constituted authority, Jesus Christ. We see also in verse 11 a strange picture. Binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vines. What does this have to do with the future kingdom of Christ? Why is this even mentioned here? Well, under normal circumstances, you would not tie a donkey or a foal of a donkey to a grapevine. And the reason you wouldn't tie a donkey to a grapevine is because, especially in this time, grapes were incredibly valuable. You tie the donkey to the grapevine, and the donkey's going to eat up all the grapes. But in this coming kingdom, there will be so much abundance that the owner can do this and afford to have his donkey tied to the vine. The donkey can eat all the grapes he wants, and the owner will suffer no great loss. Grapes and the fruit of the vine, incredibly valuable in this time, which also gives us some indication or gives us some clue as to the meaning of what comes next. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. You say, what? Why would a person do that? That's really foolish. The idea here is not necessarily that people are going to go about washing their clothes in grape juice. The idea here is that grape juice will be so plentiful, wine will be so plentiful, it'll be just as plentiful as water. That's how wonderful the conditions of the coming kingdom of Christ will be. Even verse 12, the eyes darker than wine, teeth whiter than milk, is a word picture of abundance, of health. So in the coming kingdom of Christ, there will be civil unity. People will be in submission to the laws. It will be a time of prosperity, and it will be also a time of good health. The abundance of wine is a symbol of the Messiah and his great kingdom. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that we get a little glimpse of this in Jesus' first miracle. The first miracle of Jesus is what? He turns water into wine. As we look at this passage, we cannot view this passage and miss what it says about the greatness of Jesus and the greatness of his kingdom. No one can compare to Christ, and nothing can compare to his kingdom. Well, the next few tribes are really given rather short oracles. We see in Zebulun, chapter 49, verse 13, simply that there will be a haven for ships. It will be close to Sidon. If you were here last week, I had you look at your map in the back of your Bible. Sidon is north. Zebulun would be on the coast up toward Sidon. Issachar is spoken of in verse 14 and 15. And really, there is an entire message in this oracle, which I am not going to preach tonight. But the message is Issachar was willing to trade its liberty for the material things of this life. And there is a rebuke to us that we would be willing as well to trade freedom for what this world has to offer us. We find ourselves in bondage to the things of this world because we enjoy what they provide for us. So it was with Issachar. The oracle is Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good, the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. But let's move on. Dan is mentioned in verses 16 and 17. Dan would vindicate his people. He would judge his people. There's a sense here, Dan, though it is a small tribe, will be one that will help others. The imagery here of the snake overthrowing the horse and rider more than likely refers to Dan's ability to strike out and overthrow foes that are mightier than they are. Just for on your own time, you could look to the book of Judges, chapter 18, and how Dan's power is described there. Verse 18 as well, Dan is actually given a very positive oracle. It indicates that Dan foresees danger and oppression. Dan would be a tribe that in its best moments would be like the psalmist and cry out to God, appeal to God, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Gad is mentioned next. Gad would be a warrior tribe. Gad would be renowned and skilled and almost by necessity. Once again, if you were to look at a map, you would see that they would be sandwiched with the Moabites to the south, the Ammonites to the east, and the Arameans to the northwest. And the passage indicates, verse 19, though they are attacked and oppressed first, they would triumph over their foes. Asher is then mentioned. Bread shall be rich. Bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Bread shall be rich indicates that Asher will be a prosperous tribe. Yield royal dainties indicates not only will they be prosperous, but they will produce what is the best. They will produce what is suited to be in the court of kings. Naphtali is a deer let loose. Naphtali is mentioned next. It indicates both freedom and swiftness. The Hebrew word for let loose here is often used in military contexts when a message is being sent. We look to the book of Judges, and Barak was apparently from Naphtali. But the second portion of the oracle about Naphtali is also worthy of our reflection. He uses beautiful words. They would be well known for their good words. I wonder if someone were to describe our words, describe our speech, how would it be described? I'm not here just talking about the speech that we have here on Sunday when we know we should be behaving, right? When we're acting spiritual in church. I'm talking about our speech throughout the week. I wonder if people who know us best would say that person speaks good words. But then we come to the oracle about Joseph. Joseph is given a rather lengthy section as well. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. It's a picture of strength. It's a picture of prosperity. Verses 23 and 24 recount the personal experiences of Joseph in a poetic form. Look at what it says. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. That reference there is poetically speaking of the way that his brothers treated him. They hated and attacked him. But verse 24 gives us the rest of the story. But his bow remained in strength. and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. Despite the fact that his brothers hated him and attacked him, despite the fact that the archers shot at him and hated him, Joseph remained strong. But why did Joseph remain strong? Well, some might say Joseph had great strength of character. Joseph had great personal integrity. Joseph was a powerful individual. But that's not the reason that we're given here, is it? Why is it that Joseph was able to remain strong? The arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And there is a very important point for us to see here. The only strength that can truly sustain us in the worst times of life is the strength of God. The arm of flesh will fail you. You dare not trust your own. Do you seek God? Do you cry out to Him? You will never truly cry out to Him until you actually feel your need of Him. As long as you think you can handle it yourself, as long as you think you got this yourself, you can do your own thing, everything will be all right, you have your plans, your schemes, your ways of dealing with it. Until you think that, as long as you think that, you'll never cry out to Him. Do you cry out to Him? Do you trust in Him? And then, once again, almost unexpectedly in this passage, our gaze is turned again to Christ. Notice, it says, by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Christ is our strength. Christ is our shepherd. We know Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But think also about John 10, where Jesus said, I am the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. Not only is Jesus the good shepherd, he is also the stone of Israel. The stone of Israel, God is spoken of as a rock in Deuteronomy 32 verse 4. But in Romans chapter 9 verse 33, Paul refers to Jesus as the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner. He is the stone of Israel. So even in the midst of this oracle about Joseph and what he has gone through, we see this glimpse forward pointing us to Christ. Well, verses 25 to 26 speak of the blessings given to Joseph and his descendants. By the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and the womb, blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. God, the Almighty God, the God of Jacob, would bless him. This fivefold blessing is used of Joseph and shows in some ways, in terms of blessing at least, if not leadership and prominence, but in terms of blessing, Joseph is given a superior position over his brothers. And then we find Benjamin. Verse 27 describes Benjamin as a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. We look forward in history. Benjamin would be a warlike tribe of left-handed archers and slingers. And this would not always be used for good. If we read Judges chapter 19 and 20, it shows that Benjamin would use their skill in battle to defend the wickedness of the men of Gibeah. After these men have abused the priest's concubine and have shown their depravity and wickedness in that area. Yes, God would give them great warlike skill, but they would come to use that for the wrong reasons. It's good for us to ask ourselves, how do we use the talents that we've been given? But in all of this, all of these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. He blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. In all of this, again, we see the sovereign hand of God at work. This is not just random ideas from a dying man. This is an oracle of destiny from God. And so again, we see personal responsibility and consequences for our actions. We see the sovereignty of God. We see the glory of Christ and His kingdom. But there's also a note of grace that runs through this. I've mentioned this already. Every single one of these brothers and their ancestors would participate in life in the promised land. In this, you look at these guys and how messed up some of them were. Did they deserve to go to a land flowing with milk and honey? No, they didn't. Did they, by their actions, deserve to have their descendants live in such a land of great bounty? No, of course they didn't. But we see here both the grace of God and the faithfulness of God. God had promised to Abraham, and God had promised to Isaac, and God had promised to Jacob. These promises were certain. And God would be faithful, and God would be gracious. This is the same God I hope that you know and worship today. A God who is great in mercy. A God who is faithful to His promises. He will do what He has promised. That's good news for us. It really is. Because if we know the promises of God, we remember that our Savior said, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again to receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. This is good news, brothers and sisters. We serve a God of grace and glory. And may even this passage before us remind us of the greatness of that grace.